The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business, individual, anyone, or anything. Welcome to A Little Bit Culty, a podcast about what happens when something that seems like a great thing at first goes to the dark side and takes you with it. I'm your host, Sarah Edmondson.
And I'm also your host, Anthony Ames, a.k.a. Nippy. Sarah and I met, fell in love in a, quote, self-help organization that turned out to be a mega cult called Nexium. Heard of it? We got out of there together, and on our way out, we helped shut it down. Our journey as Nexium whistleblowers was captured in detail on a docuseries called The Vow on HBO, and also on the front page of a newspaper.
New York Times, babe.
Right.
Have you heard of it? Each week on A Little Bit Culty, we talk with other former cult members and whistleblowers, plus experts in things like cultic abuse and coercive control.
We also turn the mic over to advocates and clinicians with wisdom to share on recovering from everything from MLMs and toxic religion to bad romances with raging narcissists.
There's always something to learn about the cultiverse. Be sure to subscribe to A Little Bit Culty so you don't miss an episode of littlebitculty.com. Welcome back, everybody. We have a very exciting episode for you.
Yeah, we're shifting gears here a little bit from the Teal Swan
debacle
to kind of another one. Let's be honest.
Kind of another debacle. Actually, yeah. These are all debacles, really.
I know, but Jesus.
This is a very special debacle for our heart because when we were first exiting Nexium, we were introduced to the guest that we're about to have on today and his film. And that film was a big part of our deprogramming.
Yep. Holy Hell and Going Clear were the two that I watched and was like, oh shit, I was for sure in a cult.
Nippy and I deprogrammed pretty quick, but this film was, you know, sometimes it's hard. It's really hard to admit. Like there's so much shame around being duped. Yeah. And it's hard to admit. But when you see the processes of abuse in another context, it's really hard to deny. Like we were like, oh, there it is. That's the same thing.
Yep. Yet at the same time, it was, I don't know if validating is the word or reassuring is the word to think that like this goes on. It is something that is in the world and you're not the idiot, et cetera, for falling for it or whatever.
Right. But thank goodness for all of this media out there that's exposing these groups. We actually haven't watched it yet, but another thing came on our radar in the Cultiverse. Many people have emailed us about the adaptation of Jon Krakauer's miniseries Under the Banner of Heaven. Quick tangent away from our guest for a moment.
Which we both auditioned for.
I actually had a callback for the role of Brenda's mother.
You got robbed, Sarah. You got robbed.
I feel like I got robbed. When I had the callback, I was like, this is my part. I'd already read Under the Banner of Heaven because I was prepping for the episode with John DeLynn. And I was like obsessed with the story. And holy shit, is that a heartbreaking, I mean, trigger alert, really graphic, really violent and horrific story. I just felt like given what I've been through and the fact that I already was researched on the topic, I thought, wow, this is my role. I didn't get it. Maybe I just don't look Mormon. I don't look Mormon enough, I think.
Krakauer's a great author. For those of you who aren't familiar, he did Into the Wild, Into Thin Air.
And we'd love to have him as a guest, putting it out there. And we've had a lot
He's probably not listening, Sarah.
Jon Krakauer, would love to speak with you. Call me. 604-8...
That's...
We've also had a lot of support and general love because it was your birthday last week, Nip.
It was.
And one of our favorite things is somebody sent us a word salad for Nippy's birthday, a made-up word salad about birthdays, and we're going to save that for the word salad segment.
It was a good one, and I was impressed.
But I think the most favorite thing that somebody sent me was this dream. I know you love hearing about dreams, Nip. I know that's like your favorite thing. A dream.
Wait, I have a no-dream policy in the household.
I know. That's why I have to call my mom to share my interesting dreams with her or write it in my journal.
Maybe people can comment on this.
I think dreams are really interesting, but listen to this.
They're interesting to the person telling them.
Well, I found this one interesting. Listen. Last night I dreamt that I was in NXIVM and Keith and Nancy sat me down and told me they wanted to carry Keith's child. And I looked at them dead in the face and I said, I'd rather shove my hand in a meat grinder. Laugh my ass off. My dream self isn't usually so direct, so it made me laugh that I'm so disgusted by Keith, even my subconscious wants to tell him to fuck off. That's all. Thanks for all you do. Hope you're having a great day. Thanks, Gabrielle. I feel like she channeled me because I have dreams like this
all
the time.
That one's okay because it didn't go into some like big esoteric vague thing. That was pretty direct.
I just love that our listeners are telling Keith to fuck off in their dreams.
Yeah.
That just makes me happy. I know that's not at cause, but that's okay. Anyway.
Shit. Okay.
That's a little inside joke for NXIVMers. Ex-NXIVMers. NXIVMites? Expians.
Yeah.
Let's get to our guest. Content warning. This episode contains conversations about sexual abuse, and we want to be sensitive that content like what you're about to hear can be traumatizing for abuse survivors. So please listen safely. And if you or anyone you know needs support, you can reach out to the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, RAIN. The organization provides free, confidential support to sexual assault victims. Call RAIN's National Sexual Assault Line, 1-800-656-HOPE. Or visit the Anti-Sexual Violence Organization's website for more information. We put this info in our show notes.
Okay, about our guest today. Will Allen started making films at the age of 13 in Southern California. He graduated from Southern Methodist University in Texas with his film degree. And shortly after college, he ended up living inside a guru-based society where he continuously created films about the secret world he was living in.
After finally extricating himself 2 decades later, he decided to use his archives of film footage to tell the complicated 20-year tale of his experience. He's kind of like the Mark Vicente of this particular group. Mark Vicente was the Will Allen of NXIVM.
Yeah. His 2016 documentary, Holy Hell, explores the alleged cult that consumed his life, a group known as Buddhafield. And just a note to our listeners, Holy Hell was making its first splash right around the same time we were hightailing out of NXIVM.
Will didn't just direct the documentary, he lived it and filmed it for 2 decades. So we watched it closely and it was, like we said at the beginning, very, very helpful. And we'll talk about why it was so helpful with Will in person shortly.
Will joined the group when he was fresh out of film school, looking for a community and a sense of purpose. And like so many of the stories in A Little Bit Culty, where people look for a normal, healthy thing, he found it at first.
It was good for a little while, magical even. Will became the group's in-house documentarian and propagandist. He filmed hundreds of hours of footage of the group and became as close to Jaime Gomez, the guru, at its center as anyone.
I think it's Jaime Gomez.
Jaime.
Thank you, sir. But it wasn't what it was cracked up to be. Among the accusations that linger over Gomez like a stinky cologne, one of the most horrible is that he used weekly hypnotherapy sessions as a way to procure and really to coerce his way to getting his sexual urges met. Holy Hell depicts these so-called healing sessions as a source of years of trauma and sexual abuse for many of the guru's young male devotees, including Will.
Will joined us to talk about his experience of loving and then leaving Buddhafield, his recovery, and what was really going on with all the fruit salads. That's not word salads, fruit salads. If you haven't seen it, be sure to watch Holy Hell. It is an excellent film.
Without further ado, here's our chat with director and documentarian Will Allen.
Well, first of all, let us welcome you to A Little Bit Culty. Welcome
yes.
to the podcast.
Thank you, guys.
When we first started doing the podcast and we put a list together of all the people we had met in the cult space since coming out, you were on that list right from the beginning because Holy Hell was one of the films that we watched.
Holy Hell was one of the ones that sent me in my shame spiral.
I remember.
I was like, oh no, I just saw all the same shit. Right? I was just like,
but it was so helpful, right? Obviously.
It's all that gaslighting stuff that we can't see until you see it outside happening to someone else.
Watching it for a second time, I was more figuring it out when I watched it the first time. And so, yeah, I got hits of all sorts of things, but then I got like way more nuanced, way more like watching it the second time was because I knew what I was mm-hmm. looking at more so than mm-hmm. did the first time. And it was so good to watch it a second time.
Yeah.
Especially because now we have names for those tactics. Like the first time we watched it, we were like, oh my God, Keith did that too. And oh, I totally feel that way. But now we're like, oh, love bombing. Oh, boundary testing.
Right.
Oh, causing humiliation. Yeah. Oh, like it's all very specific tactics.
We watched it as patients the first time and then as clinicians the second time, I think.
One review I had that said something like, it was like, blah, 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 the movie's so great. It almost seemed like a personal exorcism. And I'm like, wow, you know, I never thought of it as that.
How long has it been now since it came out?
It came out in 2016 at Sundance in competition there.
And that film has done so well, and I think is a part of many people's resource list. And how are you doing now? Like, what's it been like that you've, you know, put your life out there?
Oh, that was really very rewarding. That was lovely. It's only been great receptions from people. And every day we still get feedback from people who see it all over the world for the first time, right? So something about the film captured a little bit of the experiential that people can relate to, whether they were in that kind of experience or not. Just the abuse, the trust, the gaming, the imbalance of power in a relationship. People can relate to that, even if they haven't gone through what you and I have gone through. So that keeps it alive, I think. And the conversations open on different levels for people all over. So I'm really grateful for that. That's kind of all I wanted, was for it to have a great word of mouth and to reach people who needed to see it.
Well, you for sure achieved that.
Mission accomplished. Huh. For our audience who hasn't seen it, which I'm assuming will be very few by the time this comes out, but if there's anyone who hasn't, or just to remind people, do you mind giving us a little bit of the cliff notes in terms of, you know, how you got in, how you found this community, mm-hmm. what you were looking for at the time?
Yeah. And it's funny, I'll start at my college because that's when it started, but I talk in colleges now, and that's the age group when we are most ready for the world and we're most expected to take on the world. And I just got out of film school. I was 22 and I really was burnt out. And I remember not being ready to go, just go right into a career. And my sister, I was really upset and I was gay, but it wasn't okay. It was 80s and AIDS was out and everyone was starting to die. It was like so scary. And my mom kicked me out of the house because she had read something I wrote. And the next day, my sister took me to a meeting. I met people who were not judging, who were open. Mm. There was no difference. I was being seen as like this divine thing. No one had ever seen me as like, you know, I never felt beautiful until I went to this meeting, right? And I was like, God, this is amazing. I'm so far behind. I got to catch up. Let me start meditating now. So I really just kind of got on the train. I felt like that was the answer, the meditation part of it. And there was this teacher who was, you know, we didn't really get to know him very well at the beginning. He was very aloof, very far away. He would show up and disappear. But there was a social proof of everybody in the room, including my sister, saying, he's amazing. He's my therapist. He's enlightened. He can help us. He can help you. That kind of stuff. So the social proof kind of, I never vetted it. I just believed my friends. I believed these people. No one was there to hurt us. And it was all about love and meditation, very Hindu-based, very Eastern-based, but included all the religions, like from, you know, Christianity, everything. He's pulled upon all the masters and gave it to us. And we loved it. And for the first 3 years, it was just like this little growing experience. I didn't know any abuse was happening, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't there yet.
Right.
I think your film, and we try to do this with every episode, and we always have to make the disclaimer, we're not trying to show what was good as an apology, but it's important to show what was good so
what
that people
you?
See. What hooks you? Yeah. What was the hook?
What purpose was getting fulfilled in me or someone else? And we all had different needs, mm-hmm. but we're all getting some kind of purpose out of it.
Well, to your point, I think, Sarah, what you're saying is recognize how the devil greets you with a smile.
Yes.
And the smile is filling your cup with what he feels like you need. So I think that is a precursor to what potentially can be abusive. Isn't to say everyone that's coming to help you is going to do that. But when it comes dressed up as help, it's a harder thing to make a distinction.
I said this also when we interviewed a survivor from the Osho community, from the ranch in Oregon. Like the good things on the outside of that community reminded me of what you showed in Holy Hell with people coming together and being in nature and, you know, holding each other and being in the water and being in the tree, like totally my jam. Not so much Nippy's jam.
I went along with it. You know, I think it's important to go like, there are certain things that weren't my jam that I still stayed in.
Yeah, I'm just saying like with Buddhafield, like they did things in nature and together that seemed really beautiful. And I could see if I was a little bit younger in the 80s or older in the 80s, because I would have been like 5 when that was happening, right? Mm-hmm. I've been a bit older and been invited. I would have really loved that. So I get it.
The things that we did at the time, I don't know, they just seemed very healthy and natural and conducive. It is true. Compared to how we were, I come out of college doing drugs and everything. So, I mean, the whole thing was a big switch for me, like get healthy and do conscious things, you know. I think everyone on the planet should learn those things. That doesn't have to be in a group of any kind. It's just that he was our introduction to that. And that was kind of,
right.
It swooned us, you know, it made it all so good.
Mm-hmm. And I want a bookmark to ask you later, Nippy, remind me to come back to like how you feel about that stuff now. But before we get to that, okay, so things were great. And again, I loved the film. I think similarly to The Vow, I think it's so important to show people what you thought it was. Like what drew people in? What was the hook? How did it feel to be part of that community? Because there seems to be like this moment where it's so good, so good. I think somebody in your film even said this, is that the crazy stuff is always outweighed by the amazing stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Yeah. It's like crazy grandma. We have crazy people now. But look at all this good stuff. You
know? Yes.
Yeah. No, you do a good job of extending the respect to your subjects.
Well, we try to make it a human condition because we're all susceptible to impressions and only lack of information and weird decision making and things you decide when you're 20. You don't. And we're all, it's a human journey that I think we're all on it.
Well put. Yeah.
So, in all that good stuff, do you remember the first moment that you had that? In retrospect, now you'd see as a red flag?
You know, there were so many of them. And I was so well trained to like compartmentalize those. And like to not, and that was part of the journey you don't question.
Right.
Those aren't really up for grabs. That's part of the mystery. So those are red flags. Now those are red flags, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I had quite a few red flags. But most of them didn't start until he pulled me in closer to his inner circle. See, so I got really close. He started teaching me to do massage for his body, which is non-sexual, but it was still like a whole different field of knowledge for me. I was a filmmaker. So I started being his chauffeur, his practitioner, his body worker. I'd learned chiropractic. Spending time around him close up, that's when the illusion fell. That's when the curtain fell and the awe. He was no longer the big wizard behind the curtain. It was this man, this very little man with a very big ego that he wrapped it all up in, well, this is just God being God conscious. This is God as God. You know, just like we don't edit yourself. You don't have to change yourself. You just be who you are. So I had to accept him as who he was. And he was a bit of a narcissistic tyrant, you know, and asshole. Mm-hmm. And I started to take that as there's something wrong with me if I think that's wrong. You know, like everything that's wrong with him, you start taking it about yourself. Like, what's wrong with me that I'm judging him? So all your flags were really self problems that you had to look at.
It's your own limitation, Will, that you can't see that this megalomaniac douchebag is trying to teach you something.
I have a question there at the point, which is interesting to me. Like, there comes a point where I think the narcissist or whatever must realize he's not the persona he is to everyone else, right? And when he invites you into his inner circle, he must know that you're going to see how he's not the persona that he boasts.
And not judge him.
Yeah. So how do you think he knows to do that?
Because he watched me and I was a really, 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 really good disciple. I was like one of those guys who'd help everybody. And like if there was service, we'd have these things called service, like someone's moving. We need people to help them move. I'll help or I'll go. And so I was like, yes, yes, yes to everything. And that was a quality that he liked is my understanding. Right. Mm-hmm. Because he even said to someone, look at Francesco. He says yes to everything. And I heard that. Mm. I was like, I guess I do. I mean, because we were supposed to say yes to everything. Right. And so I was good at it. And I think he thought that I would be a yes man. I imagine. My sister said in one of her interviews that, Will was so, you know, sweet, non-confrontational.
That's what he abused.
He abused that. He abused my trust, my innocence and my non-confrontational. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was one moment when my trust was tested, like you would if you're around somebody. You know, if I blew it, he said, I'm never going to let you be around me again because you told that person about that thing. You can never say anything to anyone about anything you hear. Otherwise, you can't be around me. And so at that point, I just completely shut off. I cut off all my friends. I couldn't tell anyone anything. And I just became my own person observing all this. And then the flags were things I would find and hear him say and how I would see him treat people. It just didn't ring with how everything else was happening.
I really got a clear sense from rewatching it in a way that I didn't the first time, just how much everybody was very proud to serve him.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and how like they really put everything aside. And that was it felt really good to people. They didn't feel resentful at a time, I'm imagining. Like, they loved making the elaborate fruit salads mm-hmm. and carrying the bags, and which, by the way, we have a whole list of things that parallel our experience. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, God.
And that was one of them. Like, Keith was always driven. Everyone cooked his food, brushed his hair, presented his clothes.
Everyone didn't do a fruit salad. That was that one person's way of expressing their, like, exuberant love, right?
By the way, it was pretty fucking good.
Those fruit salads were beautiful.
Those fruit salads were amazing. The Last Supper? I was like, holy shit.
Isn't that funny?
How long did that take? It was amazing.
I'm so glad you still have images of those.
Now that you know about narcissistic abuse, what do you now see?
Well, I don't know if this was like it for you guys, for you all, but there was a constant fear that if you fuck up, you're out of here. And that's going to be your downfall of your spiritual evolution, whatever you're doing here, you know, your spiritual growth. If you screw this up, make one mistake, you're out. It was really scary because even though he never said that, that was the feeling. It was very Christian, kind of overbearing. Not that Christian's wrong, but I was raised Catholic because I had that bearing, like, I'm going to sin or something, even though we never talked about that. So I was always on my best behavior because I didn't want any of this to fall apart. I didn't want to tell anything that was going to make anything, ruffle anything. He also made it really clear to me, and tell me what you think about this. This is part of becoming a cult leader. He made it really clear that his work with each of us was individual. So if I interfered, like if I interfered with your work, Sarah, and I said, Sarah, did you know that he's blah, 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 blah? He would come back to me and say, you are interfering with her karma. Mm-hmm. You are fucking up her chance to work with me. And if you interfere that's your big problem, right? And so I would never interfere. Mm-hmm. I would just let him do whatever he did with everyone else, thinking that he knows best.
Yeah.
My impression, Sarah, and because we were never in Keith's circle, it never felt like that to me in our day-to-day. But I do get a sense, an impression of watching what went on in Holy Hell and what I've heard has gone on in Keith's inner circle is those are very similar climates. Yeah.
Division. Cults will separate you from society, or they will alienate you, but not literally. They will they will figuratively do you from your parents and your friends and stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. Well, mine was even a little worse because I got removed from my group, my new group of friends, like my new family.
Right.
You know, I couldn't even be with them when they were what I really loved, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And so that for 3 years in, I got removed. I was just around him the whole time. And that was like another level of being removed from even that society.
Yeah. So isolation within isolation.
Yeah.
Like Nippy said, we thought we were kind of upper rank. We were upper ranks, but we weren't inner circle. So we had certain privileges and we were part of certain meetings, but we didn't live in Albany. I wasn't part of Keith's harem. But I did notice that, you know, with the women that were my friends, my really good girlfriends, I thought were good girlfriends, they didn't share with me that they were in a sexual relationship with him, because same exact thing he told you and the others, that other people can't know about this because they won't understand.
They won't understand. It's not for them.
Yeah, they won't understand. Yeah.
Yeah, the first time he did this with me, when he brought me into that relationship, my teacher was like this with me. It's very special.
Right.
It's very special.
To your point, Sarah, the culture of fear that Will's describing, you said you had many experiences of some of the women in that circle that felt like they were living in a culture of fear, right? They always had to check in. Didn't they feel like they were scared a lot?
They were always on high alert. And there's so many things didn't make sense until we got out and we found out that all this sexual relationships was going on. And I think that both of our respective leaders were very successful in compartmentalizing and making sure people didn't talk or share under the guise of, they won't understand, you're special, this is just for us. And so then people don't talk, people don't share these things. And if you ever did, then you'd see the whole picture.
And the people who it's happening to probably don't recognize it as sexual abuse or abuse yet. It doesn't fall under that level. And this is how I realized this is after making the film, I kind of finally wrapped my head around the abuse and the level of unconsensual sexuality that was happening. How do you know that when you still don't even know who you are and you're still forming it? Well, this is how I knew. And I'm going to share this with you because anyone out there who has this experience might understand it. If right after that act that you're having with that other person is like, he would have this sexual relationship with me once a week, and the tension that would build up to that night, to that day, was so intense. And as soon as that was over, something in my mind would say, okay, you're okay for a week. You're okay for a week. Huh. Just everything's going to go back to normal. You're okay. And so I would forget about it. He would act normal. I would not tell anyone. It would all be compartmentalized. And then Tuesday would come around. I'd be like, oh, Thursday's coming. And Wednesday would come. I'm like, oh my God, tomorrow night. And then Thursday would come. I'd be like, oh my God. And then it'd be over. I'd be like, okay, you're okay. Jesus. You're okay. It's another week. Everything's back to normal. So I never saw that. I just saw that as my personality, having a problem with something that I was being given, right? But that's abuse. And that's what you need to listen to in yourself. Mm-hmm. If you are in any relationship with anyone and you're feeling like, I can't do this, thank God it's over. Well, you need to look at that.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org. Can you tell our audience and bring us through the moment of actually deciding to leave?
I'll say the moment that I really actually had the power to leave was after it had already started to break up and all of my friends and family were departing. Half of us left, half of us didn't, half of us didn't know. I was so bound to him. I was just like tied to him. I had no money. So I was with him until he went to Hawaii, but I also had a little partner at the time that I'd gotten into a relationship with the last couple of years, and he was like my strength. And I was more in love with him than I was with anything that was going on in the group. And I think my inner commitment to the group was to serve the group as a whole. And when it started to fall apart and everyone started leaving, I was done. And I said, there's nothing here to serve. I don't believe this anymore. This is all wrong. We started to come out of the damage. We're starting to come out of what was happening and letting it soak in and really acknowledging the truth. And so at that point, because there was no one really left there, that my brothers and sisters, we weren't doing it anymore. We just stopped. And that's what allowed me to get out, because I thought I was there helping. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought we were all there helping each other. Mm-hmm. And we weren't. We were hurting each other.
Yeah, just to backtrack for a second, what was the catalyst that caused the group to dissolve? Was it the people who were writing letters and trying to shine light?
The letters really helped shine light. The letters and people talking and starting to talk really, really helped shine the light. There was a moment when I was in Hawaii with him when he said to me, this is after 20 years of like me serving and 14 years of me driving him and taking care of his ass.
Literally.
He looked to me in the backseat of the car. I was driving the car and I told him I wanted to move out of the house. I go, listen, we're in Hawaii. Me and Boyd are looking for a place. And he goes, if you've ever done service, now is the time to do it. I go, what do you mean if I've ever done service? If you've ever done any service in your life, now is the time to do it. You can't leave. If people see you leave, I go, listen, if you can't keep people here, I'm not going to keep people here. They're not here for me. They're here for you. I'm leaving. And that was when I told him I was leaving. But he turned it into I have service to do, and that is to keep people there, right? That was his, like, he thought that would be my thing. Like, you can't do that. So it's going to put a bad impression out there. Is this ringing true for you guys at all? This kind of, he's protecting his image. He was still protecting his image. He was still trying to protect his image using us as human shields. And I was like, no, it's over. It's over. You know?
Yeah. Well, he recognizes your power.
At that moment, I had the power the whole time. Yes. I had the power whole time. And I didn't use it.
He knew that.
You did now.
I did now. Yeah. But I mean, at the moment, I never thought I could just walk away and I'd be okay. Never.
Right.
Well, that's such a key part of the abuse is,
it is.
Creating that belief. And every single cult survivor we've spoken to has that, I think it's called implanted phobia. Like what's going to happen if you leave? Mm-hmm. Right? Like you're going to, I think many people said in your group that they would be dead within a year.
Plane crash, do things, AIDS. You're going to die if you're not with me. If you're not with me, all that grace is going to like dissolve, all that protection.
Yeah, we didn't have that. Ours was more like, you'll never work through your issues. You weren't going to die.
Yeah, same process.
Yeah, you're going to go backwards. You're not going to make it. You're not going to achieve what you're trying to achieve, whatever.
You know, one of the things that Sarah and I were talking about and pointed out to Sarah is, you know, why the need to humiliate. And I think the humiliation, you know, we know that Keith attempted some things at the end to up the humiliation. And I think the assumption in that is if people knew the truth about me, they're going to know the truth about you. And it's going to humiliate you. So the reason I'm abusing you is to keep you in. Mm-hmm. Because if the truth comes out, you're humiliated. And I know you're afraid of humiliation. So for instance, remember when he was putting food in the women's mouths and they were like crying and they were talking about being humiliated?
Mm-hmm. I think what you're saying is like in moments where he's shaming and humiliating people, the shame, it's a bond that's being created with him and their shame.
Right. So I now have the goods on you too. So if I'm going down, you're going down.
There is an element of once you're in and that you're committed. And if you're committed, I go down, you protect me, I protect you. There is all of that incestual, yes. But that is manipulative control. You're right.
For sure. Also, I'm not going to be motivated to come clean with all this because it's humiliating. I have to humiliate myself in order to hold this person accountable.
Right.
And I think that's a hard thing to do. It's a brave thing to do, but it's a very difficult thing to do because you have to eat your own crow. And so I think all your subjects were brave in that. And I thought that was the most commendable thing about this whole process.
No, it's true. We're all part of that, you know, what seems like a shameful journey or at some point, because we all take on the crimes of the leader when they weren't really our crimes. Right. It's like I got out and I was talking to someone. I had a psychologist after a while because a friend of mine had her and he said he was suicidal. I'm like, well, I'm not suicidal. Maybe I need to talk to her. He goes, you've been dealing with a narcissist. This is in 2000. This is before I made the movie. And I go, well, I need to talk to her since she already knows I'm dealing with a narcissist and it's damaging. And so I saw her. I asked her right away after a couple of sessions. I go, I'm so worried. Like, am I a narcissist? Because, you know, I spent so much time. We all spent so much time around him and like following him and, you know, believing him. And, yeah. And we are. And she's like, no, no, no. She goes, you know, a narcissist would never even ask that question.
They wouldn't even assume
that it could possibly be a defect of their, they wouldn't even ask that. I mean, it's like never, it's not even a, you know, they don't even work on themselves on that level. You know what I mean?
No, because they're perfect.
Right. Yeah. I thought it was interesting in your story. And tell me if you remember this or tell me about this. Because Mark had told me this when I first met him. And he had said that your teacher was so clever in the fact that he actually even had classes about narcissism and what to look out for. Mm-hmm. And this is what to look for, you know, and we kind of did that too. We kind of laughed like, yeah, we look like that, but we're not, you know, and it was so clever to not have you look at him because he's self-aware of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we since learned that sociopaths love to do the thing that, act in plain sight?
Like taunt you, like with a mouse and a cat.
Yeah. To do it right in front of you so you'd never suspect it. Yeah, he taught us about narcissists. He taught us about sociopaths.
He told us what they did.
And specifically how they would, like, people who are unethical, suppressive sociopathic people would create problems in the world that cost a lot of money and then also benefit from the cost of fixing the problems.
So interesting.
And that's exactly what he did to us. He basically exposed these issues, and we were apparently working on them as we become joyful and enlightened, but really we were focusing so much on our shit, on our patterns and our issues. We were like, we felt like shit, and we also felt if we bought in, which many of us did, that we then had to keep paying to go on the path, the straight path, fix our shit. But like, really, we're not broken in the first place.
That's something that happened a lot. Someone brought it up in our we had hypnotherapy with this teacher. He was our hypnotherapist back in the day.
Right.
And we would work on, we'd regress therapy, go back to your child and kind of beat up whatever it was that you didn't have the power to as a child, perhaps as a baby or, you know, 5-year-old, you know, you say, fuck you,
Or a 45-year-old.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Here we were, 45 years old, still saying, fuck you, fuck you. And this one girl goes, every time he kept bringing me back to my fucking crib. For 15 years, every problem I brought to him, he would say, let's go back to the crib. And she's like, I don't want to go back to the crib. It's not happening there. You are keeping us infantile. You are keeping us small and back stuck by recurring the problem over and over again, never really getting us out of it. That happens when you do excessive talk therapy. You know, are you really healing that? And so, you know, we got a lot of benefit from hypnotherapy with the first first couple of years and the first couple of sessions. You get a lot of relief from any kind of self-hypnosis, you know, that you've had your whole life. You know?
Any sort of inquiry.
Yes. And that seems to be a through line too. Mm-hmm. There has to be some sort of legitimate, actual, in our case, mutually, you know, this therapy that's useful and you have these moments of release. And then from then on, you're trying to like get more of that.
Absolutely.
Right?
That's right.
Chasing the high. First one's free.
The first one wasn't free though.
Yeah, that's true. It's $50.
Wow. Yeah. The other thing that makes it's hard to get. So see, we weren't allowed to go to all the classes right away. You had to wait. You had to kind of like Some people, once we got to Austin, they had to wait 3 years before they even got to meet him. So that makes the prize so precious. So once I got to go to class, once I got to go to the movies with him, the condition was once you get invited, you can't quit. So the value was so like, so we went to class. I went to class every week for 20 years. Oh, these are acting classes, you know, we all did. You couldn't quit. If you didn't go 1 week, it would be like, what's wrong? You remember how badly you wanted this?
So the scarcity mentality, and then you have like embedded FOMO, right? It is FOMO. And he uses that, like that one woman, Emiliana, I think Emiliana was her name, when everyone was presented with the knowing. And Jess, our producer, when she was helping us prep for this episode, was like, anytime knowing becomes a noun, is like, should be a red flag, right?
Yes. It's interesting you say that. He took it from the knowledge. Okay, he got this technique called the knowledge. And he turned it into what he called a verb.
Yeah.
Knowing.
Okay.
It was a noun called the knowledge, but putting a the in front of it does make it a noun. But the knowing itself is an ing word, like it's an ongoing living knowledge, not like a solid knowledge. So that was his twist.
Got it. Got it.
It's a verb noun.
It's a verb noun is what he's tried to
that
make.
That title was a noun. That was a title. The knowing. Yeah, that was a title.
Right. So everyone got the knowing, but then Emiliana she wasn't quite ready. And I just felt her deep inadequacy and how he used that. And she stayed for so many more years to one day get the note. Like, it's just like, what an asshole. I was so mad.
And to have that pain that she talked about still be so active 15, 20 years later, that's a PTSD trauma.
Yes.
That how could someone who's supposed to be so, you know, aware and enlightened, you know, be so insensitive to everybody's true psyches, their true developmental process, you know, what they need, what they don't. But this was her, she's been sad about that because it made her feel like she was rejected by, you know, everyone else is better than her forever.
Right. And I'm sure he did it in a very loving way. So she couldn't feel like, I would take that so personally too, as I felt that pain.
But 17 years later, when the group was falling apart, then he said, now I'm going to give it to you. Now I'm going to give it to you. That is terrible.
Right.
Yeah. And then he goes, he just basically threw it at her. She was so, that made it even worse. She's like, wow, I waited for this. And he treated me like that just to keep me like bound around his wing, his finger. Right.
Yeah.
And that was terrible. Yeah. So that's even insult to injury. Right. Yeah.
Absolutely. I was actually curious. So do you think that the hypnotherapy that he did was legitimate because I do believe that hypnotherapy can be used as a good tool if you're trained properly. Do you think there was some good stuff in there at the beginning?
He did basic training back in the day. We all think he got his license back on like one of those cheap kind of licenses you get for quit smoking. And he added his own thing to it. But, you know, he only probably trained a little bit, never retrained, never kept getting retrained, never learned the new things. We felt like he was very limited after a while. But it was never the kind of hypnotherapy where I would be able to get up and not remember anything or become a chicken. I've never done that. I've never quite believed that for me. I've never been able to become that, you know. That's a different type. I was always aware. You were always to be present. And your mind gave you the journey yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, he kind of helped you. It was always really lovely. We all liked, that was like the best part. We all couldn't wait to get therapy, you know, to talk about our problems. And he was a willing ear. He loved to talk about it. He loved to talk about it and loved to help us. So that was something that was helpful.
Yeah. I mean, the cleansing sessions did seem quite similar to EMs or explorations of meaning in Nexium, where we like looked at a past thing in your childhood and
let it go.
Let it go, or like looked at it with new data, as they called it. And since learned that's like basically therapy 101.
Yeah. Your mother didn't really hate you. She was doing the best she could. You know, you were just pooping. You just wouldn't stop pooping.
Right.
Yeah. You know? Well, that was actually one of the questions. Like, what if you knew then that she did it because she loved you, you know?
Yeah.
Which is ultimately the arc of getting to know your parents afterwards and having hindsight. You know, I mean, we all come to that awareness, I think, at some point.
You know, my mom said to me in our interview, my mom's like, well, he just taught you to hate us. I'm like, well, mom, he didn't really teach us to hate you. I mean, he actually taught us to love you and to like, you know, just not spend any time with you. Just not to hang around you.
You can love them, but also cut them out of your lives and shun them.
Right.
Where do you think like the background of his knowledge, do you think he just like pulled from books?
He was a reader. And he read Osho. He read all of Osho's books.
I was going to say, it sounded like Osho.
There was a section in the movie with Osho, because he would all, that's what he'd read every morning, night and day. He'd outline it. He'd have books that were covered in dust. We had to put plastic covering so he could read his old books about Osho's books. He would not allow us to read Osho because he was basically stealing his material and regurgitating it to us, keeping certain things out, just telling us what he wanted to tell us. all the hoo-has, all the nature, all the...
Yes.
That's all Osho.
That's what I thought looking at it.
Yeah. But then he'd also study books on acting, class books that are, you know, different acting exercises. He'd work it all in there. So we were always exposing our ego and then mm-hmm. having an exaltation type thing.
Did you actually find some of the stuff
oh, yeah.
that he stole? I went and found some things, and I some of it was like stolen verbatim.
You know, I would watch him. He would talk for 2.5 hours or 3 hours sometimes, like a satsang. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like he couldn't memorize it. There's jokes, there's timing, there's breaks. Everything leads to one thing. It's like, it's hilarious. It's funny. He, you know, jokes aren't easy to tell, right? He could tell a joke.
Right.
He could tell a joke with his broken English. And it was funny. I'm like, where is he getting all this shit, you know? Is it just coming through the universe or is he like copying somebody? So that's a good question. I think he was an actor. He was trained to memorize. So I think he memorized right. a lot of it. Jokes, I know he'd memorize because those are hard. But other stuff, he would just kind of like take it all in and just regurgitate it.
Did you ever see him planning this out?
Yeah.
You did?
You know, I never saw him memorizing. No, I have to be clear about that. I never did. It was a question I had up until the very end. It wasn't until we were in Austin the last couple of years. He would give a big Christmas dinner. It was the first time he'd see people. And he would give a big, the Last Supper message to everybody. And I wasn't close to him at that point because I was such a rebellion. He didn't like me around him because I had such a raised eyebrow with everything he would do. He would do a lot of things in private. And he would go with Julian, the boy who did the fruit salads, and help him memorize his hour-long speech. And my friend told me, he goes, oh, he's in there memorizing it. I go, is he really memorizing it? He goes, yeah. And I've been around for 20 years and I didn't know he was memorizing it.
Really?
Hey, A Little Bit Culty listeners. Bless your little bitty hearts for helping support this podcast. You asked us to put a link up where you could make a one-time or monthly contributions to help us cover the costs of taking this podcast from our living room to your earbuds. And so we did. And wow, you weren't kidding around when you said you wanted to help this podcast keep on cranking out episodes. You stepped up. Thank you. In fact, in a relatively short time, 70 of you have already chipped in. And together, the whole beautiful lot of you have covered the cost of making almost 5 full A Little Bit Culty episodes. That's pretty freaking good. You are amazing. Did you know that? And yes, we're talking to you, Veronica Wells, Annie Blake, Thomas Wicks, and John Breen, and you, Kenny Bernstein, and Kristen O'Rourke. You rule, Sarah Priestley and Roger Seidman, and you are rad. Andrea Padillas, Helena Durst, Sally Lotz, Joel Blair, and Jolene Bishop. That's just a few of you who are helping to make this podcast happen. Want to make a contribution? Just go to alittlebitculty.com/support or the link in our Instagram bio. Every little bit helps keep A Little Bit Culty trucking along. Thanks again. We adore you. I was just looking at my notes to make sure I didn't miss anything. And I wrote here, same kind of therapeutic emotional release as Osho, but hipper and in the 80s.
Yeah, Osho came right before him. We think he might have gone there, but the whole thing with touching our forehead and putting his it's called Shakti, like on our forehead.
Yeah.
I didn't know mm-hmm. where that came from. We all thought, well, he's enlightened, he's doing this thing. It wasn't until years later, because we weren't allowed to watch Osho too much or read him, when I started to make a movie and I started to put Osho in my film, I saw Osho footage of him giving two people Shakti at once, like touching their forehead, right. Two people, and they're shaking and he's doing, and I'm like, oh my God. Michelle saw that and he thought, I can do that.
Right.
He was right.
What do you think was actually happening? Like, do you think people just want nothing? Okay.
No, just kidding. I mean, something's happening. It's just up to you.
That's what I think. That's my impression.
Nothing happened to me. I just felt like I wasn't very open. You know, I'm like, oh, I'm so intellectual. Oh, you know, and because, but sometimes I'd be like, wow, I was really blown away and I felt really peaceful. And the next day I felt really overwhelmed with love for no reason. And I would give some attribution to that. I would say, oh, it's because the Shakti. But really, it's because I'm meditating all day. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we kind of are that thing. We are that chemical factory ourselves. And I do believe that there's like a tuning fork element to our lives. Like, you know, Nippy, like if you were in a good mood, you know, you could hit your tuning fork and make Sarah in a better mood. Vibration mm-hmm. can change things, right? I think mm-hmm. that happens sure. with people. And I think that that's kind of what we thought we were getting from him. Like we were kind of vibing off each other.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But he took credit for it all. Like,
for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's also a key distinction between Osho and him is that Osho is also encouraging this release and free sex And that was part of the deal. This seems like he wanted everyone to have this release, but not the sex, because he wanted to control that.
That's right. It's even different than that. It's okay. Let's say the narcissist will never, ever go to jail, because the narcissist will never get caught. They don't want to go to jail. So he was studying Osho's downfall. Ah. Osho's downfall was all the rings, all the Rolls Royces, all the sex, all the people being so transparent. Mm-hmm. No, we are not going to talk about sex. We're not going to be transparent. I don't want a lot of money, and no one's going to know who I am. So he took all of his teaching, but he hid. We went underground.
You were underground for 6 months, right?
Well, not underground. I mean, not literally.
Well, like you weren't around.
My question, Will, is the part that I'm interested in seeing these things and kind of where I am at is now is at a certain point, it is the emperor has no clothes. And it seemed he was getting worse. Like, because you have 20 years of footage, you could see like it was polished, it was tighter in the beginning, and then it started to crumble a little bit. And I always wondered, and I wondered this with Keith, I wondered this with Jim Jones, at a certain point, it's obvious the emperor has no clothes, at least to the viewer.
It's obvious to me too.
Did he amp up?
Yes.
Did he know? Like,
things amp up. What that does is it makes things even more intense. He amps up and he starts to increase his level of control, increase his, I need to control this person, not saying something to that person, saying something to this person. I need to control. He started to control all of our lives in a much bigger way because I think he was losing control. And we were all growing up too. We're not supposed to be there for more than a couple years and something like that. You know, we were there all outgrew everything we were doing.
Right.
So he had to create new things, create new techniques. Here's the ascension. Now, when I touch you, you're going to smell something. Now he's like, oh, there's a whole new thing that you can't leave because I'm going to give you this new thing that I've discovered. So he was creating his grandiosity more and more. He had to keep reinventing himself to keep our attention. It wasn't working for the older ones, but it was working for the younger ones who've just been there for a little bit, who are just coming. And emperor's clothing is a great way of saying it.
Yeah.
Keith did that too.
Keith would release new curriculum.
Just before we left, people always ask, how do we leave? It was at one moment. It was cumulative, obviously, like it does for everybody. But one of the things that happened is that he introduced this university program. He was like, all these young people shouldn't go to university. They should come to Albany and I'll teach basically everything you need for life in this university program. And it was so expensive. It was like, wasn't it $5,000 a month, Nip?
$5,000 a month. And you were doing like logic problems and geometry and shit like that.
Yeah, it was basically a cobbled together thing of all the classes that already existed in Ethos, which was $300 a month. But now it's university and like, it's a commitment. You're going to go up the straight path. And I was, as a salesperson, I was supposed to sell it. I didn't put anybody into it and I got shit for it.
We told people not to do it.
I was telling people not to do it. I'm like, on the sly, like on the DL, I'm like, between you and I would not spend $5,000. Like, go to actual university if you want.
Right.
He was always trying to reinvent. Yeah. That was actually one of his downfalls, as he kept trying to do these new companies and new, like the acting program and the ethical media program and the emotional bandwidth program.
What did he do with all this money, though? I mean, where did he?
We don't even know.
Well, none of it was in his name.
Like, why was it so important for him to have more and more and more? I mean, see, our teacher chose not to have money so important. He came from a rich family in Venezuela. So money really wasn't part of our spiritual, didn't get mixed up in there. I mean, it got mixed up in service and like you give your time and your life.
So I think that's how he secured service.
Yeah.
So if you were a student who really wanted to do the $5,000 a month thing, you could come on an exchange. Oh, and the exchange was labor.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So he threw out a curriculum that was, you know, half-assed a lot of the times, but and charged a high price because you were working off your $5,000 a month as a student up there.
You guys were way more accomplished than we were. We were like 20-year-olds. We really didn't have a lot of like money. So he wasn't really able to milk us, which is, you know, or even ask us for that kind of stuff. And we just didn't have it.
Yeah, well, there was definitely a mixture of people in there that had a ton of money, like people who were heiresses and billionaires. When I started, I was living in a basement suite. Like I didn't have barely any money. If you wanted to take training, you were basically offered that opportunity, like Nippy said. It was like an exchange program. And so in every training, let's say there was 30 people paying $6,000, there'd be at least 5 or 10 people running the training, putting out the food, cleaning the toilets, handing out the notes, Xeroxing.
Even taking it.
And taking it. So he never paid staff. Well, he may have paid the head trainer to teach it, but the staff running it, the people making it happen, were there on exchange. So they'd get to get the training for free, right? They'd have to work the training, be a participant in the training, work their issues. Right. But then they would owe like then they'd have to then commit to doing that same thing, that service or that exchange for another three trainings to pay back the training that they just...
That's crazy.
It's so crazy because the hourly amount for the work was like $12 an hour.
That's the crime right there.
It was brutal.
I mean, the labor laws that, that Keith broke is, you know, insane. Oh, but it's an exchange. Like you get something out of it. You're learning how to be a coach. You're learning how to blah, 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 blah. Which actually is a great segue. I think I'm going to read you my little list of all the similarities.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Yeah, let's do it. This is, we were making a list of these last night. We're like, because we just saw it. We couldn't see it the first time. And like, it was so obvious.
Well, listen, Will, I have to tell you, every guest we have in any type of cult, there's certain cultic abuse things that are always the same, right?
You know, sure.
Love bombing, the isolation, you know, the creating a dependency, all those things, right? But there was very specific things with Keith. And do you call him Andreas or Michelle now in your mind?
That's a tough one. We refer to him as Jaime. We like to go back to his given name.
I was going to say, you got to go back there.
Let's just go back to his given name. Let's call him Jaime. He hates that too because he doesn't like being like, you know,
Jaime
Gomez because it sounds kind of Mexican. He's a little bit racist.
Homophobic
and racist, yeah.
Oh, geez. That's a good combo. A lot of people in NXT, we either call him Voldemort or Van Douche or Alan. His middle name is Alan, Keith Alan Ranieri. Here's our list. I'm just going to start with neither of them liked fat people.
Yeah, right.
You'd get in shit. Like you couldn't go up the stripe path. There was one guy who was a four-stripe coach when I came and a four-stripe coach when I left 12 years later because he was obese. Drank too much coffee, lazy, satiative, really good at the tech, really good person, really like should have been a head trainer, should have been making a ton of money. Was always broke because he was too fat to get promoted. Okay, that's one. Okay, well, I mean, we already covered the secrecy. Like you can't tell anybody. Yeah. A lot of private relationships. A lot of just like creating the honor of serving the master. And we didn't use the word master.
Privilege. We didn't use
the word either. Yeah.
We used Vanguard, sir.
It was a privilege.
We called him by his name. And it wasn't until later that we started to, you know, actually use like guru maybe or, you know, master. Mm. It was really uncomfortable.
Well, both of them would stand there and in their, like Keith called the satsangs, called them forums. But he also did a similar thing that Jaime did of being like, I'm not a guru. I'm not a master. Please, like I joke with you. Like that sort of like sort of faux humble, you know?
The faux humble. And the humble yet, brag.
At the same time, making sure all his needs are met by his minions. And then having this obsession for Alan, it was volleyball. For Jaime, it was ballet.
Something that Julian said to me in our film, he goes, he lived like a millionaire. And he goes, he had people who washed his clothes, did his food. But Julian was saying this to me. And I was thinking like, I didn't understand what he meant. Like live like a millionaire. Like what's the benefit of that? Like living like a millionaire, not being a millionaire. Well, now I understand, you know, I can't afford, you know, we all want to be able to afford chefs, chauffeurs, gardeners, window washers, toenail masseurs. I mean, of course we all, you know, for us to afford that, one, we'd have to like have amazing work and a lot of free hours. And so he did. He lived like that with no money.
Right.
Exactly what you're talking about, just from service. And he lived like a millionaire's lifestyle, but never paid a dime.
Right. Yeah. So maybe it's not even so much about the money.
Yeah, he didn't abuse the money, but he had all the perks that you'd want.
Yes. It's another way of getting the lifestyle.
Uh-huh. Right? Smart.
Smart. Yeah. Noted.
You have to be clever to do that. Yeah.
He was definitely very strategic. And yeah, I think we covered this already, just the humiliation, putting people in a situation to maintain the secrecy. If you were to break secrecy, will cause your own humiliation. And Nippy reminded me how after we had left, he was hiding out in Mexico and he'd summoned basically the first line DOS members.
Well, it came out in the court transcripts through Lauren, to be clear. So this is what Lauren said. As I understand it, he was organizing a group blowjob session.
Really?
Yeah, it was interesting to me after seeing the humiliation tactics, that he retreats to Mexico when one of the first things he wants to do is have everyone recommit their vows, and the way they have to do it is totally humiliate themselves.
Oh my God.
That to me is the humiliation piece I was talking about earlier. It's like, you're not going to run from me after you just did this.
But also like logistically, how do you get six people on one penis? Like, I don't
know. You take turns.
Like, how does that even work?
You take turns.
Oh, you take turns. Oh, thank you, Will.
Just look at Jaime, right?
Jaime wasn't that ambitious.
Early Jaime Gomez filmography might reveal that.
Oh, that's true. He had a few multiple encounters.
Speaking of which, thank you for sending us that footage that didn't make it into the film. I mean, the porn that you included in the film was shocking enough, but there's a lot of footage that didn't make it in the film. I'm just curious, how was that decided?
He was getting a workout in while he was having
showing
sex.
Showing off, you mean? Yeah, showing off.
It's like multitasking. I'm just going to multitask here.
In all seriousness, how did that footage, separate from the porn, which I can understand, but there was a lot of really good footage that I felt was even more damning on Jaime. Why was that cut? Or why did that not make it in the film? You sent me some links of like extra stuff about some of the things he had done, how he'd like gone after his defectors and tried to harass people.
Seeing him was fantastic, and they let us keep the porn in even on their channel. But there was a couple things they said that we had to take out that they thought that he could fight it. He could fight. And that was the letter. There were things in the letter, even though I set up the letter, because I had a good lawyer and I know what I'm doing. I mean, theoretically, I was following my lawyer. Yeah. I was following my lawyer's advice. I was learning what I was doing. I was learning.
Yeah.
And he says, the letter was, this letter came out, stating, accusing him of these things. And these were the accusations. He did do tax evasion, but we were accusing him of tax evasion, accusing him of having a felony record for hustling. The CNN says, well, do you have proof on that? And we're like, no, all that stuff's been reversed and like gotten rid of. He goes, well, we really can't say it. But I go, but the whole letter is like, this letter came out and confused us because this person was saying we didn't know what was true or not. It's part of the story. Like, we didn't know what was true. Yeah. They go, well, it's probably better if you can't, if you don't have proof of it, you really can't say it.
Right.
And the other thing was, there's a moment with my sister, Sarah, Emiliana is my sister.
Right. I forgot that. Yes. Emiliana is your sister. Yes.
It's hard to know.
Yes.
At the end of the last act, in the third act, she was given the knowing finally, when she was finally given the knowing after 20 years. She says, people are trying to hurt me. People are trying to hurt your master and you need to stop them. You need to make them go away. And she goes, and I mean, Heman have them killed. She goes, I mean, Heman have them killed. She said it twice and they made us take out one of those. They go, you can't say what he meant. You can't say what he meant. So she goes, just say what he said. And she can't say, and I mean, I guarantee you he meant have them killed. So we took out the second one. And I was like, no. Right. I go, that's all we have. It's like, no, we have to get out. Soften the blow.
It still had the punch, I think.
Yeah, okay. It absolutely did.
And just to wrap up my list, the other two things that were, just to go back to that for a second, is the abortions.
Oh, yeah.
Keith instructed many abortions.
All of them.
I mean, I wept deeply at the end of your film, specifically for the women who lost that opportunity because of this Jaime. It's so terrible what he did.
Totally selfish, because it wasn't for their spiritual growth. It wasn't that they weren't meant to be mothers or have this amazing divine experience raising two or three children. That might have been in their cards. He got in the way because children would have looked bad for him. Basically, all about him. It was just all about him. So all the guidance he gave us for our lives were about him. Like, what's going to keep me safe? What's going to work for me? What's going to be a flag? We can't have children here. You don't need children.
That's just more attention away from him,
and
too.
And so wrong, too. Like, my spiritual growth has been the most heightened because of my children.
Yeah, of course.
And what a beautiful, magnificent gift that I've had.
Because you basically, I'm going to be presumptuous, but, tell me if it's true because I don't have kids. But, you get that unconditional love. Mm-hmm. It's like unconditional from you. And that's kind of what we were manufacturing with him. Mm-hmm. It was like, oh, we love our guru unconditionally. Like, he wants you to love him like a child, like you would a baby. Children would interfere with that love.
Right.
Because they would take it away from him and they would put on a child where it should go.
Well, and you'd also start to experience for real what he's hypothetically telling you you're experiencing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You just reminded me that Keith actually taught us that unconditional love did not, like, that's actually unhealthy, that you need to have conditions on love, because otherwise you're, like, if you have that with children, it'll take away from holding them accountable. Yeah. And do you remember, Nippy, like, there was a whole fucked up...
Well, the idea is love is earned.
Well, those are two different things. Those are two different things, though.
Totally.
Yeah.
Because, like, we're all here breathing probably unconditionally. So, I mean, we haven't really earned it. So, let's see how Steve goes with that one. But
And the other similarity with many spiritual teachers is, of course, the eye gazing.
Yes.
Deep, deep, deep eye gazing, which I don't know if you remember the eye gazing in The Vow, where Keith meets Allison and stares deep into her eyes and she, like, dissolves.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We've had a lot of experiences like that. Do you want to hear something you might not know?
Yeah.
I learned about our boundaries, like, because I didn't know what boundaries were until my first relationship out. I was with a trauma specialist and I was at his yoga retreat. We were learning about boundaries. And I was like, what are boundaries? He goes, oh my God, Will. Boundaries. So you know, boundaries are, first of all, our space here, you know, these kind of boundaries.
Yeah.
So something else I had read since that, when I got to learn about my boundaries and I learned how to say no if something doesn't feel right, you know, is our eyes are our first line of defense, or our first boundary is our eyes. So when you're in the grocery store and you look at someone and you go, hi, and they look at you, if they look down, that's them saying, I don't want you in me. You know, you're not, this is my boundary. Yeah. I'm not looking at you. I'm not inviting you in. I'm not saying hello to you. I'm not whatever. It's like, I'm boundary.
Yeah.
Your eyes. So for you to release that guard, any of us, and to let that come in, you're really breaking all boundaries. I mean, you're letting go of all boundaries. It's a huge thing. You do it with your lover. You do it with people you love. You do it with people you trust. Perhaps, you know, you do it with people who you're in a relationship with, you know, that you're welcome. But to do it with strangers and do it all the time and expect you're supposed to be like that all the time is like really, well, I think Steve was right, like love with some conditions there.
Yeah, imagine yourself walking into a forest. You can see the path and the trees. High above you, the air is crisp. You are walking towards your happy place. Allegedly, say it with me. Anything said here on this podcast about alleged cults, alleged MLM schemes, alleged douchebaggery, mindfuckery, criminality, spiritual fraud, or the like, is offered purely as commentary, because the views and opinions expressed on A Little Bit Culty do not necessarily reflect on official policy or position of the podcast. And any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. So just let these words drift into your mind without needing to focus on any of them. You are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. Nobody's mad at you, unless you're actually a narcissistic, culty criminal. If that's you, cut that shit out. Don't be a fuckwad. But if that's not you, again, you are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. A Little Bit Culty loves you.
So that was part one. Be sure to come back soon. A couple days from now, we'll be launching part two. Before we do, again, happy birthday from me, Nip, and from all of our listeners. Please share our birthday word salad.
Yes, thanks everyone for the birthday shout outs. It was unexpected and really great to get. Erica Mac 18 with the birthday word salad. It's interesting. A birthday should not signify our birth, but yet the light that our energy has given to this earth. We are born in a sense of clarity, yet suffer in the process. Its meaning is not the truth, but could be something more specific to that truth in the joy that's embedded in the idea we created for ourselves. Thank you, Erica Mac 18.
That's so good. Erica Mac, that's so sweet of you. God, we love our listeners. So supportive. Love the interaction. Love the love. Would you say that this is a healthy community that we're building?
Careful, Sarah.
Oh, man.
Careful, Sarah.
It's hard. It's a hard one.
Let's talk to Will Allen in part two. See what he thinks about it.
Part two, come back soon. See you next time. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean.
Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO. If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. Takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound.
Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.